is there something wrong in what we learn about connecting the world? At the time of Arab Spring, everyone thought, wow, what a great thing this is, connecting the world there.
It was such an enchanting dream that that connecting us all closer together was going to bring us closer together.
Sex for favors, secrets, cover-ups, corruption.
Such a nasty one.
Pizzagate is real. Do you understand that? I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap.
Det virker som en evighet siden nå. I 2011 sveipet protestbevegelser over hele verden. Det begynte med den arabiske våren i Midtøsten, men også i USA, Europa og noen land i Asia var det store demonstrasjoner. Synet på internett og sosiale medier var et ganske annet da. Opprøret i Egypt ble kalt en Facebook-revolusjon, og de første protestene i Syria ble filmet av vanlige folk med smarttelefoner og spredte seg raskt på nett. Det hersket en idé om at internett og sosiale medier kom til å binde oss sammen og gi vanlige folk muligheten til å bringe sine opplevelser ut i en global offentlighet. Det skulle gi oss mer demokrati. Bare 5 år senere blir Donald Trump valgt til president i USA. En mann som har et mer eller mindre uttalt mål om å plukke fra hverandre demokratiske institusjoner. I løpet av årene som har gått siden, har vi blitt stadig mer bevisst på hvordan desinformasjon og manipulerende innhold på nett bidro til fremveksten av the alt-right og valget av Trump. Bevegelsen mot det autoritære har selvsagt dype røtter ute i verden utenfor skjermene. Men dette er historien om hvordan det rådende synet på internett og sosiale medier gikk fra optimistisk utopi til håpløs dystopi på 5 korte år. Jeg heter Tore Årseth, og du hører på Oh My God, Get The Fuck Out. Hvem ødela internett? Jeg begynte denne serien med et spørsmål. Hvordan kan det ha seg at internett og sosiale medier ble sett på som et vidunderlig verktøy for demokratisk deltakelse i 2011, men bare 5 år senere var det blitt til et verktøy for hat, trakassering og desinformasjon? I løpet av de 3 første episodene har jeg fått litt innsikt i hva det var som skjedde i løpet av de årene. Men hva med løsningene? Problemene som gjør at nettet i dag er langt fra den idyllen man så for seg før, er mange og spesifikke, men de henger også sammen. Vi har mobbtrakassering, som er målrettet og drevet frem av alternative nettsteder og karismatiske personligheter, men vi har også mer dagligdags trakassering, som bare kommer av at det har blitt etablert en aksept for dårlig kultur. Vi har problemer med sensur, men også med at et unyansert syn på ytringsfrihet blir brukt som argument for å legitimere oppførsel som til syvende og sist fratar andre grupper sin ytringsfrihet. Vi har mer eller mindre harmløse konspirasjonsteorier, men også bevisst desinformasjon som spres for politiske formål. Overvåkning fra stater og fra de store plattformene diskuteres både som et problem og som en løsning. Men hva er egentlig mulig å gjøre uten å samtidig skape nye problemer? For å finne ut av det, er den første utfordringen å sette en presis diagnose på problemet. En av de som kan hjelpe meg er Ari Waldman, jusprofessor på New York Law School, sør på Manhattan. Waldman jobber med de juridiske aspektene av trakassering på nett og startet den første jusklinikken, en ordning som ligner den norske JUS-buss, hvor JUS-studenter hjelper folk som har vært utsatt for trakassering, identitetstyveri, hevnporno og lignende på nett.
Is this close enough? So when I started my academic career, which was September of 2010, that was a month where several queer boys and girls committed suicide as a result of incessant online harassment, as well as offline harassment. So it was formative in my academic and professional career. And as a gay person, it was personally powerful. There is a back and forth dance between the creativity of harassers and legal and technological responses. And those are going to continue because there's no one law or there's no one technology that's going to get rid of terrible behavior by online users.
Hmm. Can you say something about what is the impact on the victims that you've helped?
The impact of revenge porn or online harassment on victims, it can be devastating. There are personal, professional, social implications. There are also social effects. When someone that you trust distributes a photo that you sent to them in a context of trust, that breaks down the protections that we expect from trusted relationships. And that has an effect on society as a whole. You are less willing to trust other people. And society is better when there is more trust among individuals. So there are significant psychological and personal effects. People lose their jobs, people lose their homes, people have to leave, people have to can't date, people always feel hopeless and always feel harmed.
Mm. So since you started this work, Donald Trump was elected president, and he's been criticized for engaging in bullying tactics online as well. Can you say that him being president has had some sort of effect on the stuff that you're working on?
Donald Trump has had nothing but a negative effect on norms and safety online. His behavior online specifically has allowed other people to behave in a similar way. His politics has brought racists and bigots and homophobes out from the sidelines to be even more upfront about their views. And when you have the not just tacit but explicit approval of the leader of the country to behave in bigoted, fascist, homophobic, in misogynistic ways, then you're going to give license to other people to behave in those same ways too. We have noticed an increase in physical hate crimes that has been documented by the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League. We've seen an increase in online harassment, as also documented by these organizations. So, and we've seen also larger proliferations of hate groups online, whether it's on fringe social networks like 4chan and 8chan, or if it's on even on Facebook and Twitter, which inspired by Donald Trump's behavior, people feel much more willing to engage in their worst behavior.
I andre episode av denne serien gikk vi inn på hvordan en stor andel av den russiske desinformasjonen på Facebook før det amerikanske valget i 2016 var rettet mot svarte amerikanere for å demobilisere eller hindre de i å avgi sin stemme i valget. I og med at de aller fleste svarte stemmedemokraterne gir det en fordel til republikanerne når den svarte befolkningen har lav valgdeltagelse. Og selv om denne typen desinformasjon og trakassering på overflata ser ut som to helt forskjellige ting, mener Waldman at begge er taktikker som kan brukes målrettet for å redusere marginaliserte grupper sin innflytelse i samfunnet.
Both disinformation and bullying tactics are an attempt to silence minority and marginalized voices. Because when you bully someone, when you harass them, especially when you harass them for their identity, but when you make any space unsafe, you are encouraging them to leave and you're encouraging them to silence themselves. Disinformation also has the same asymmetrical effect. Because when you are stronger, wealthier, you have more of an opportunity to flood information markets with false information. And you can target people. It's far easier to target marginalized populations in disinformation campaigns than it is to target people who are not vulnerable. So both have the effect of silencing marginalized voices in online spaces, which contributes to a feeling that you can behave in terrible ways as marginalized voices continue to move to the margins and quiet down.
Et av de vanligste motargumentene når spørsmål om å slå ned på ugreie ytringer på nett kommer opp, argumentet om ytringsfrihet. Jusprofessor Danielle Citron mener at dette ikke handler om ytringsfrihet mot sensur, men om hvorvidt en person sin ytringsfrihet skal få forkjørsrett foran en annens.
So I view myself as a civil libertarian, that I am committed to and value free expression. But when it comes to harassment and stalking, and the reason why the First Amendment does not shelter harassment and stalking is because it is a perfect storm in the United States. We'd understand it as unprotected speech or speech that enjoys less rigorous protection. Why? Because it does so little for self-governance and democracy and truth and is so destructive. Like, so what is there to say to a rape threat? What kind of counter speech? Don't rape me? And defamation, you know, the suggestion that I have herpes or I'm a prostitute, it's a lie. What is there to say? No, I'm not. The reason why we have laws against defamation is because for the private person, it's really hard to debunk the lie because we remember the lie, right? It gets lodged in our cognition. And privacy invasions, the theft of a nude photo that I took with my husband that's stolen from my iCloud account and then posted all over the internet. That's not protected speech. That's a privacy invasion, right? If it's posted without my consent. So there are very hard problems about free speech. Stalking and harassment, by my lights, I'm less worried about the speech of the harassers than I'm worried about the speech of silenced, harassed victims who go offline.
Jeg spør hva Citron mener om nettsidene som ofte henger ut en navngitt person på en måte som de må skjønne kommer til å mobilisere mobben, men ikke selv deltar I den etterfølgende trakasseringen.
That's a great question, and we've seen that come up in the United States with neo-Nazi, the Daily Stormer, targeting specific private individuals because they have some interaction with a neo-Nazi and it doesn't go well. And then those individuals are mobbed. I call them cyber mobs and tormented with all the things we're talking about, rape threats, death threats, right, privacy invasions, defamation. And so who's responsible, right, is the question. Because the cyber mob, not one person is responsible for the whole thing. And what about the person inciting it, right? And so in the United States, we have a case against the head of the Daily Stormer for encouraging, inciting, and eliciting tortious behavior. And it got passed a motion to dismiss. So if those websites are, if they're truly just engaging in fake news and writing fake stories, there may be opportunities for counter speech. And what's hard is when they target a private person, right, and they suggest that they've done something they've never done, and they know the mob is behind them ready to pounce, I think those are come way closer to what I would call prescribable speech of incitement. So I think we've got to be careful, right? We can't do any of this with a blunt instrument. It's all, we got to use a scalpel for all of these issues because they're hard. And it depends on the exact circumstances, the exact context, exactly what's said, who's involved, right? And that's really important. So it's hard to have this sort of broad brush reaction. We've got to be really careful, but we also can't give up and say it's free expression. Because when you incite a mob, right, whether you do it in person or you do it online, it can have damaging consequences. And so I think the very idea that we're saying it's ones and zeros and you did it online and so it's free speech is an absurdity. And I, you know, with all of my, what I do with my work is to fight against that idea.
Nylig har det nynazistiske nettstedet The Daily Stormer blitt dømt I to forskjellige saker etter å ha mobilisert rasistisk og antisemittisk hets mot to enkeltpersoner. Men det ikke alle former for trakassering som kan defineres som et overtramp etter loven. Soraya Kemali, leder av Women's Media Center Speech Project, peker på det som skjedde med Katie Boumen, forskeren som stod I spissen da det første bildet av et svart hull ble offentliggjort tidligere I år. Hendelsen et eksempel på at handlingene til en samlet mobb utgjør målrettet trakassering mot en person eller en gruppe, men på en måte som gjør det vanskelig å si at en enkelt person har gjort seg skyldig I trakassering som var så grov at den lovstridig.
What we see is more subtle forms of harassment. So ruining a woman's Wikipedia entry is one way that women have been targeted, right? So if you think of Katie Boumen, who was the woman pictured in the you know, the black hole. One of the first things that was done was that people edited her Wikipedia entry in a harassing way. They also set up fake accounts in Instagram. They went into GitHub and, you know, commented on how poor her coding skills were. I mean, it was a complete assault on her reputation. And it was a misogynistic assault on her reputation because, in fact, all of these men were outraged that any woman could be named a singular genius. And she was part of a team and she's not that smart. And oh my God, this, you know, it was just insane to watch in real time. This poor woman, all she did was share an excited picture of herself, you know? And so that kind of the full scale harassment, I think is pretty emblematic of what we're up against in a way that isn't necessarily associated with hate, right? It's not that someone's calling her a cunt. It's that they're saying, well, she's not that smart and she's incompetent. And her Wikipedia page, she's not notable enough to have a Wikipedia page, right? Even the notability requirements in Wikipedia are gender biased. Wikipedia itself writes about how its notability requirements are gender biased. So I'm like, okay, well, why don't you change them? Okay, if you yourself understand how they're biased, why is it that you are giving this tool to some random man in Michigan who then decides that all 100 of the BBC 100 women are not notable enough and takes their profiles down? So that's how the problem of harassment becomes systemic, you know? And each platform has its own flavor of that fuckery. Excuse me. Are you recording every? I'm getting all heated now.
Denne kampen om å få definere hva som sant, kanskje en av de mest sentrale problemstillingene ved tida vi lever i. Og muligens også en naturlig konsekvens av åpningen for større deltakelse som kom med Internett 2.0. Det virker åpenbart at den tilfeldige mannen i Missouri, som ikke kan få seg til å tro på at noen kvinner betydelige nok til å ha en Wikipedia-side, ikke bør være den som bestemmer. Men han nok i det minste overbevist om at det han som har rett. På den andre siden har vi falsk informasjon som produsert med hensikt. Her den teknologiske utviklingen nå kommet så langt at de metodene vi hittil har brukt for å avsløre falsk informasjon kan være ubrukelige om kort tid. Danielle Citrone har begynt å forske på de mulige konsekvensene av såkalte deepfakes, både for privatpersoner som blir utsatt og for samfunnet.
So, you know, we've long had altered and faked audio and video. So it's not a new, the notion of altered audio or video isn't a new concept. You know, Photoshop's been around forever. But the technology in the last 8 months or so, there are technologies that are based on artificial intelligence or neural networks that can create out of digital whole cloth, just out of literal images of you, have you doing and saying things in ways that it's very hard to detect it's a fake. And so the technology has gotten so sophisticated that even folks whose business is to find fakes are saying that within about a year or so's time, it may be that the white hats can't catch the black hats. That because the technology is so sophisticated, there will be fakery that you can only debunk with real journalism. Like, were you there at that time and said that thing? But that's hard to do in the moment. So when you release a deep fake of a politician saying and doing something that person shouldn't do, like bribery or buying drugs, and you do it on the night before the election, and you release it, and you change the election results, yes, a week later, we could figure out that that politician wasn't actually soliciting a prostitute or doing drugs or getting a bribe, but that's a week after the election. So the concern, and that this is something I've written about with Bobby Chesney, a colleague at University of Texas, is the concerns not only for its exploitation to hurt people, individuals, and that's been my general focus of my work, is the deep fake sex video. Whether it's a celebrity that we saw last summer, you know, those subreddits devoted to deep fake sex videos of Hermione Granger, you know, Emma Watson and Jennifer Lawrence, Gal Gadot, but the everyday person. Who faces in a Google search of her name, fake pornography?
Can anyone make these?
Anyone, and they're deeply democratized. Yes. So if you go on YouTube, you can find tutorials about how to use your desktop program to make a deep fake. and you need as little as 50 photographs of someone. So what Bobby and I wrote about when we came together was the concern not only about the exploitation of deepfakes to hurt people, individuals, and to hurt companies, like night before an IPO, you release a deepfake about the CEO. That's really damaging, and then the IPO falls apart. So not just exploitation to hurt individuals and sabotage careers, but its potential to hijack democracy and its potential to undermine national security, right? So when I say national security, it could be domestically as well, right? You release a deepfake on the night after Freddie Gray is murdered in Baltimore by Baltimore police.
Freddie Gray var en 25 år gammel svart mann som døde I politiets varetekt I Baltimore I 2015. Dødsfallet utløste voldsomme opptøyer I byen, og myndighetene svarte med å erklære unntakstilstand og sende inn The National Guard.
We already were in great unrest in my city. Imagine the deep fake of our mayor saying something like, I'm glad he was killed. My city would have burst into flames, right? We're worried not only about domestic unrest, of course, but the negotiation between diplomats that's upended because of the incredibly difficult to debunk debate that suggests that the person on the other side of negotiations isn't genuine. And that's the deep fake you never know about because the negotiations just end, right? And so, and Bobby's a national security scholar, so we came together and wrote about the potential for mischief, not just individual potential, you know, to harm people, individuals, but the societal damage and the damage to democracy, right? We're in this age of decaying trust, right? And the video is something you always say, but you can believe your eyes and your ears. Yeah, that fake news, I'm paying no attention to it. But video is so viscerally powerful. And we always say, oh, but if you see it, you have to believe it. And so that's why the deepfake, it really worries us about the mischief it could cause, but also to the kinds of privacy invasions it may drive us to embrace to fend off the deepfake. Like, will we engage in persistent self-surveillance because we want to be able to prove we weren't there and didn't say that thing? And that worries us too.
Så, hvilke midler finnes det for å løse problemene med trakassering og desinformasjon? Mye handler om politikken til de store plattformene, hva som blir sensurert og hva som blir løftet frem. Men Gillian York fra The Electronic Frontier Foundation ikke så sikker på at løsningen ligger I hva de store plattformene tillater.
I've been looking at what I call platform censorship, for a long time. And of course, right now is a really strange time to be looking at this because now we're seeing this sort of the conversation around it shift toward this, you know, the things that like President Trump is saying about, it's conservatives being censored on platforms. But when I look back at what I was looking at 10 years ago, the reason that I got concerned about this issue was actually, I'm not going to remember the very first person that I ever talked to about it, but the things that I was seeing around 2010 were Tunisian activists getting kicked off of Facebook for criticizing the government. I was seeing Moroccan secularists have their pages taken down because they were criticizing their government. And so what I was seeing was sort of the flip side of it, marginalized groups being censored by platforms, either because their governments had requested it or because it, you know, a content moderator took the content down, whether it violated the rules or not. And so over the years, that hasn't really changed. Yes, we've definitely seen it encompass more groups. Of course, yes, conservative voices are also censored from these platforms. That's true. But I think that marginalized groups are still the ones most impacted. And the reason for that is this, you know, when Alex Jones or even President Trump himself, if they are kicked off of Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, they still have a lot of power and a lot of influence. They can start up another website. They can create their own platform at this point. But when a marginalized person or group is removed from these platforms, often they don't have the same ability to, you know, to start up something else, to get the same reach that they previously had. So content moderation has always been this kind of inconsistent practice. You know, you've got people all over the world doing this job. They're required to look at the content really quickly and make a snap decision. And as a result, a lot of mistakes are made, whether it's a human content moderator or an automated one. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of that happen over the years. Even the examples that I gave just a minute ago, the Moroccan secularist in 2010, that shouldn't have been taken down. It was a mistake or even a bias. We don't know, partly because the companies don't tell us. Do we want companies like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube having this amount of power? I mean, nobody voted for them. They're not elected. And they're not even really qualified to make these decisions on any expert level. And so I think that these are important questions that we have to be asking ourselves as societies. And, you know, from my personal perspective, taking off my kind of work hat here, my personal perspective is that I think that censorship can be acceptable, but it needs to be democratically determined. And that's not what's happening right now, just about anywhere. There are still concerns about how platforms make decisions about what constitutes harassment. So, for example, just 2 weeks ago, there was a journalist who was being mobbed on a platform, a woman, and she responded by, you know, sort of engaging in counter speech against her harassers. And what happened next was that she was the one who got kicked off of Twitter. She got permanently suspended. And actually, what the text of what she said was, it was just so unbelievable. She said to this one guy who'd been harassing her and encouraging other people to harass her, she said something like, "Is that really the hill you want to die on?" Which is a common phrase, you know, is that really the issue that you want to keep arguing? And the person, the content moderator who saw that, or the, you know, automated tool, we don't know, saw that phrase, saw the "die on" and the "die" probably, and determined that she was the harasser. So I think that sort of illustrates why it's still problematic, even in that context, to trust companies to do it. Luckily, because she was a journalist, she had the blue check mark, all of that, she was able to get her account back. She was able to appeal to Twitter through friends, contacts, maybe even press pass, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But for a person who doesn't have that kind of reach, that kind of platform, they don't necessarily have the ability to get their account back. And we see this all the time, lately on Facebook in particular. There have been a lot of Black women kicked off for engaging in counter speech against harassers, and particularly because they've taken the harassing speech that they've received in like a direct message or in a comment and reposted it to illustrate, look, this is what people are saying. And the automated tools or the content moderators, whatever it is, they don't recognize the context. And so they take the speech down and sometimes kick the person off. And I think that that's why we just have to be really careful when we implement these things. It doesn't mean that we can't take down or kick off harassers from platforms. It just means that we need to look at all of these different aspects before we, you know, push them to do this. And that's what worries me when I see groups saying, oh, just, you have to do something about this. You have to do something about this hate speech. Okay, but do what? I think you have to really think through what that means and come up with processes that ensure that the least amount of collateral damage happens.
I andre episode snakket jeg med Shafika Hudson, som var en av de som steppet inn og avslørte en politisk desinformasjonskampanje på Twitter I 2014. Hudson mener at plattformene trenger å ansette flere folk som moderatorer, fordi algoritmene aldri vil kunne forstå kontekst eller forutsi når strategiene som laget av mennesker endrer seg. Men York mener at algoritmene også har en viktig plass.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the tricky things here is that the automated processes in some ways are better for labor practices. This is also not my expertise, but the way that I see it as a human is looking at, you know, these content moderators, a lot of them are getting paid quite little. Although we did just see last week that I think Facebook upped the pay rate for their moderators, which is fantastic. But they're getting paid little. They're not always getting the psychological support that they need. They're looking at really graphic stuff every day. And so automated processes in some ways make that better, right? They make it so that this person sitting in an office in Bangalore doesn't have to see beheading videos. I would say that's a good thing. You know, it's sort of always been very strange to me that we've sort of deputized people of color from the global south to, you know, cleanse these platforms so that we don't have to look at the graphic images. I mean, when you think about it that way, it's really sort of a toxic thing. So automation's good in that respect. On the other hand, we have to be careful about automation, and I'm worried that, you know, companies have not really always thought that through. There's a lot of bias in algorithms. Every person brings their own experiences to the table, and the engineer who's building an algorithm that determines what is or is not terrorist content, for example, they're bringing their own biases about who a terrorist is, what a terrorist attack looks like. And so, you know, in part of that is why we've seen policies and automated tools really targeting jihadi terrorism as opposed to, say, white extremist terrorism, or whatever you want to call it. That comes from the bias of humans who build the tools or who make the regulatory decisions.
I første episode snakket jeg med York om hvilken betydning det har hatt at de som dominerte det tidlige internett og bygde de store plattformene var blant de mest privilegierte I samfunnet. Heller enn sensur mener York at noen av problemene kan løses ved å se på hvordan plattformene bygd opp. Arkitekturen former både adferd på plattformene og hvilke muligheter folk har til å håndtere uønsket ting.
It sort of goes back to what we were saying in the beginning. That the people who thought about the promise of these platforms were thinking about the promise for them. They weren't thinking about the promise for everyone, necessarily. And sure, I mean, you know, platforms have always benefited all of us in some ways. But if you don't think about, you know, for example, the way that... let me give a concrete example here. I use, you know, tools like Signal and WhatsApp to send messages. And both of them require me to share my phone number with the person that I want to message with. Now, this is sort of a change from the past, because if I was using AOL Instant Messenger or even Facebook Messenger to some degree, any of the things that we used in the past to chat one-on-one, I could use a handle. I could use a fake name. I could use, you know, whatever. But now that the phone number has become the primary identifier for these tools, it means that, you know, if I want to chat with somebody that I just met on Signal, I have to give them my phone number, which means that they can call me in the middle of the night, they can harass me. I think that the people who built these tools didn't really think about that problem. They just saw, okay, well, a phone number is something that we all have, it's an easy way of identifying somebody, it's only one person can have it, and so, oh, there, that's a good solution. But the downside of that, of course, is, you know, somebody has my phone number, and then I'm going to have to change it if they keep harassing me.
Mens antallet mennesker på nett har vokst voldsomt, har samtidig trafikken blitt konsentrert rundt noen få store selskaper. Google, inkludert YouTube, Facebook, som også eier Instagram og WhatsApp, Twitter, Amazon og Netflix, for å nevne noen av de største. Disse firmaene står for det meste helt fritt til å bestemme hva som lov og ikke, og hvilke valg brukerne har med tanke på sikkerhet og personvern. Jeg spør York hva som egentlig problemet med at så få firmaer sitter på så stor makt.
If we look at history, I mean, I think that there's a really interesting interplay here with both surveillance and free expression. If we look at history, there are a lot of movements that, had they been censored or heavily surveilled and therefore required to self-censor, they wouldn't have been able to thrive. So, you know, just less than 100 years ago, in many countries, it was illegal to be gay. It was illegal to engage in homosexual acts, to, you know, to be out and proud and all of these things. And so making it legal required a lot of organizing. It required a lot of protests. It required rioting. And it was a fight that happened over many, many years, many decades. And so had those groups been watched more closely, they may not have been able to thrive, and we may not have seen those movements be able to happen. The same goes for things like scientific inquiry. I mean, had scientific inquiry been stifled even more than it was, we might still think that the Earth is flat. And so it's important that groups be able to engage in free expression, and that includes without being watched all of the time, because that's what allows us to change societies. Of course, that's true negatively as well. It also allows groups to change societies in ways that we don't want, and I think that's what we're seeing right now. But I think that really speaks to the importance of creating democratic processes around this. So we don't allow authoritarians to thrive more than progressivism.
problemene med trakassering, desinformasjon og mobilisering av ekstreme synspunkter og vold mot utsatte grupper ikke bare noe som skjer i USA og Europa. Propagandavideoer på YouTube og rekruttering via sosiale medier har i mange år vært en kjent strategi fra IS. Mer nylig har ryktespredning og falske nyheter på sosiale medier ført til antimuslimske voldshandlinger på Sri Lanka, og hatytringer på nett var også sentral i forfølgelsen av rohingya-folket i Myanmar. Fenomenet globalt, og det omfattende. Nylig meldte Facebook at antallet falske kontoer har økt voldsomt det siste halvåret. De fleste blir tatt av algoritmene, men mange kommer seg gjennom filtrene. Bare de tre første månedene i 2019 ble over 2 milliarder falske kontoer slettet. De fleste bare få minutter etter de ble opprettet. Men Facebook estimerer selv at rundt 5% av aktive kontoer falske. De andre store plattformene har også tatt grep. Twitter har for eksempel sparket ut både Breitbart-skribenten Milo Yiannopoulos og konspirasjonsteoretikeren Alex Jones. Jones også utestengt fra YouTube. YouTube har mottatt mye kritikk for algoritmene som gjør at man stadig får servert mer ekstreme videoer enn den man ser på, og at dette har bidratt til radikalisering. Nå nylig tok plattformen grep ved å fjerne kanaler og videoer med konspirasjonsteorier og høyere ekstremt innhold. Der de før kun tok vekk videoer som eksplisitt oppfordret til vold, også ting som holocaust-fornektelse dekket av den nye policyen. Men det ikke alltid de store plattformene klarer balansegangen og vite hva som bør sensureres og ikke. Selv om YouTube, ifølge Washington Post, hadde jobbet 1 år med den nye policyen, gikk det likevel med mange videoer som ikke burde vært tatt ned i dragsuget. Det ble fjernet både historiske videoer med Hitlers taler, videoer med kritisk gjennomgang av høyreekstremt tankegods og journalistikk om høyreekstremisme. Organisasjonen Witness har tidligere påpekt det samme problemet i en annen kontekst, nemlig at den samme policyen som skal ramme IS-propaganda og voldelig innhold, ender opp med å fjerne videoer som lastet opp fra for eksempel krigen i Syria, som viktige for å dokumentere menneskerettighetsbrudd. Etter debatten på Cooper Union tar en prat med Carol Cadwella, journalisten som avslørte Cambridge Analytica-skandalen, hvor detaljert informasjon om Facebook-brukere ble brukt for å målrette politisk reklame. For Cadwella er det ikke nødvendigvis plattformene sine policyer som problemet, men det at de har fått så stor makt i utgangspunktet.
Well, it's such a huge problem. I mean, it's such a, in just a very few years, you've had this concentration of money and data and power in the hands of just a very few individuals, these American companies. And it gives them a power and reach into people's lives in every country across the world, which has never been seen before in human history. So this is an unparalleled situation.
Could you say something about the challenge of getting people to care about this? Because it's sort of abstract. It feels like when you log off Facebook, it no longer concerns you.
Yeah, so I think that's always been the thing of realizing that it's about you. It's deeply personal. It's about every aspect of your life being harvested and invisibly. You don't realize that it's happening.
You said that social media, or I don't know if you meant the internet as a whole, you wanted to compare it to Gutenberg in the printing press instead of getting radio and newspapers 100 years ago. Why do you think that the change is so fundamental?
Because it's just a complete revolution in the distribution of information. It changes who has information, and it changes the way that ideas and political messages can spread. And there really hasn't been anything like this, you know, for several hundred years. And because we're living it, we kind of forget the way that our world has changed so radically in this tiny amount of time. And it's hard to get that perspective and realize kind of what's happening around us.
On the subject of elections, like, What do you think will happen in the next British elections and the next American elections, and can we trust them still?
So no, we absolutely can't trust them. So the point is that the electoral laws that we have in Britain and in America and across Europe, they don't work anymore, because there's no way of regulating elections and money when you have a company which is a sort of black box into which any individual or company or organisation can pour money and create ads and, you know, subvert an election. And that is the reality. So, no, they're not safe at all, I don't think.
Jeg spør Kadwalla hva som hennes forklaring på at det gikk så fort nedover med internett, eller om vi bare var naive I 2011.
We were just naive. And because these were very young companies run by young, charismatic individuals who, you know, were well-intentioned. And so we weren't alive to the ways that this could be used for ill and the way that bad actors could game the systems for their own ends. And, you know, we're waking up to that with devastating consequences now, that we've sort of sleepwalked into a situation and there's no real way out of it. So, yeah.
There's no way out?
Well, I mean, there are ways. I mean, we've got to think of what they are, but the power has been concentrated in the hands of these companies, and there's no obvious, like, immediate route back from that. So, yeah. Sorry, not a very cheerful way to end the interview.
Jeg heter Tore Åtseth, og du hører på Oh My God, Get the Fuck Out, Hvem ødela internett? Produsert for Radio Rakel med støtte fra Medietilsynet. I introduksjonen hørte du nyhetsklipp fra CNN med Donald Trump og Hillary Clinton, Alex Jones fra Infowars, et klipp fra Gamergaters on Steam som har brukt stemmen til Jesse Ventura, og opptak fra Pan America's International Voices Festival. Musikken Corey Webb med Capsizing fra Tribe of Noise.